Miami of Los Angeles, West Los Angeles.
Good evening. My name is Norma, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come here and share my experience, strength, and hope. It really is an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know about you guys, but I am here with them, you know? Now, I also want to thank Helen. You know, the greatest thing is sponsoring our wonderful hostages, you know, and she was willing to take the day off from work and come with me, so I'm very grateful to you, Helen, for coming with me. I want to welcome all the newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want you to know that it works good, and it works slow, huh? You can tell I'm a Mexican, right? And I love the Mexican variety that my family has parties Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And in the olden days, we would buy six packs of cases of beer. They bought kegs of beer. You know, with those big blocks of ice and those chunks of salt. And they used to put it in the bathtub. You know, I believe I was born with the disease of alcoholism. I also believe I was born a liar, a cheat, and a manipulator. That comes natural to me. And when I was a kid, they used to think it was cheap to give us all a glass of beer. So I used to go from relative to relative to get me that beer. I loved the way cheap beer tasted. And I remember I used to go into the bathroom and pump me some of that foam. I love cake beer foam, you know, and when I was a little girl, I used to live behind my grandmother's house. I adored my grandmother. I think God always provides someone safe for all of us out there. You see, my mother was an alcoholic. And I remember we used to live in this little house behind my grandmother's house. And I remember I used to sleep in a little walk-in closet. And I have an older sister, and she got to sleep with my mother. And I remember I used to wake up in the middle of the night crying and running for my mother. You see, I never felt my mother loved me enough. I never thought I was good enough. I never felt wanted. And that's when I used to wake up in the middle of the night in that closet with all that clothes above my head. I used to cry, and I used to wonder why I couldn't sleep with my mother. The truth of the matter is I ripped a bed. That's why I didn't get to sleep with my mother. But when you're 4 years old, you don't know that's the reason. I just felt unloved and wanted. I just felt rejected. Like I said, I was a battered kid. I was always getting beat a lot. You see, at home I was very timid. At home I was very sneaky. And, you know, my grandmother, you know, they never used to let us have candy or soda or potato chips when I was a kid. And my grandmother always had a 2-pound box of seized candy in the refrigerator. And when nobody was around, I'd sneak in there and start slamming it in my face. I still eat it that way today. And my mother would show up. And she'd say, Norma, did you eat that chocolate? And I'd say, no. She'd get me, give me that rapid fire. Did you eat it? No, I swear I didn't eat it. She'd grab me by the arm, take me to the moon, there'd be chocolate all over my face. And I don't know how it got there. You see, I would lie under any and all conditions. My head said, don't tell. I was terrified of my mother. It said, don't tell. The price you pay for telling the truth is so much greater than if you stick to the lie. So I always stuck to the lie. Once I said it, it was the truth. Whether they caught me or the goods. And when I was 8 years old, we moved to Mariloma. I don't know if you guys know where that's at, but it's all cows and chickens. I had this 3-day baptism. I was 8 years old when I had my first blackout drunk. It was 3 days. I remember it was Friday and then it was Sunday. And I remember I came to, it must have been about 1 or 2 in the afternoon, and I was walking around that house, and I could hear them inside talking about me. Did they see how drunk I had gotten? And who had given me so much? And that was the first time I was at shame and remorse. I didn't know what I did, but I knew it was bad. And Martha, are we troubling Catholics? Have there been any Catholics in here? But I remember when I was a kid and I used to go, you know when you used to go into this room, you know, Catholics go in this room and they tell the priest their sins. You know, I'd go into this room and I'd tell them, well, maybe I lied once or twice or stole a half a time. I never was going to tell anybody the truth. And in the morning, you're supposed to take this little host and you're not supposed to eat till you take this body of Christ tonight. I always ate just to see what God's going to do. You know? I was always testing the water. They said God was going to punish me, so I was waiting for it. And you know, when I was a kid, like I said, I was a battered child. And I remember my mother, when she used to beat us, after she would come over and she would cry and she would love on us. And I remember my mother used to always say that my daddy was sick and he loved us a lot. You see, but my mother never cleaned it up for herself, you see. She always cleaned it up for my dad. She always said he was sick, and she never said she was sick. You see, when I was a kid, I remember going out to where the horses were, and I remember singing to God and praising God and loving on God and begging God to please bring my daddy back. Because when my daddy was around, my mother wasn't so violent. And I remember I used to look for them in the barn where we keep the hay and the oats. And I used to think that someplace, somewhere, my mama and my daddy were gagged someplace. Because like I said, my mother was also very violent, but very loving. And when I didn't find my daddy or my mother, I got mad at God. And I gave him the finger. And I said, I am never going to pray to you again. And I meant it with everything I had. When I was 10 years old, my mother got sober. I went to Alateen, you know, and my mother moved us to Pomona. I don't know about you guys, but we lived in farmland before. She moved us to Pomona, where the girls dyed their hair. Your type fit in the fourth grade, okay? And I remember they used to read books every day after school to give us our initiation. And I cried to the teacher, they're going to beat us up. On the last day of school, the guys and the girls got together and they cornered my sister and they jumped her. And I remember she was pinned against the fence and I remember seeing her crying. And I ran after a car and I got some car and a gentleman came and pulled my sister out of there. And he took us home. And I remember as soon as my mother got home, we told her what happened. And my mother got on the phone right away. And she started calling the school district. And she made sure that the next semester my sister didn't have to go to that school. And one more time, I wasn't loved enough. One more time, I wasn't good enough because I had to go back to that school. And every day after school, those girls used to wait for me to give me my initiation. And every day, to cry to the teacher, they're going to beat me up. I'm also a Mexican reject. You know, I wasn't raised on beads, rice, and tortillas. I was raised on pot pies, tea dinners, and bologna sandwiches. My mother was an alcoholic and she didn't cook. She made beads one time and she put spinach in it, okay? You know what? I liked it. It was good. But I remember when my mother got sober, she decided to go on a diet. And so before we didn't have any, we used to have bread and sugar, but none of us any carrots and celery and that nasty diet Shasta soda with that aftertaste. So we used to do these little burglary feet at other people's houses. So I looked at a good burglary at somebody's kitchen, and I never thought about stealing their stuff. I was only there to eat. And in the older days, they had those double desks. Some of you might remember those double desks. And the girl I shared my desk with, a white girl, I wasn't intimidated by a white, I was intimidated by a Mexican. Anyway, I called her a monkey and she took it personal. So, when I went to my eating excursion, she's coming down the playground, right, to confront me about calling her monkey. And she has a couple of friends with her, and she gets in my face, and her mouth starts to move like my mother's. It starts perspiring above her lip. The next thing I know, I hit her. I blacked out. I broke her arm. All those tears. I said, don't cry, Norma. Wait till you get to the bathroom. You see, finally, somebody was going to pay for the things that were going on in my house, you see. Not only was I a victim to my mother, but I was also a victim to my sister. At home, I was a victim, physically and emotional. I was timid. I was sneaky. I was meek at home. And that day, I learned to be a victimizer. So I started letting the world. Started taking in my mother's kids. And I told the charity as I'm doing this. And you know, my mother was a great AA. She went to meetings every night. From 7:30 to 10 o'clock, Mama was at the meetings. From 7:30 to 9:45, we had the boys over. We're doing a little spray paint, a little glue, you know, drug choices, whatever you got, you know? And there was no alcohol. I mean, we were 10 and 11, and there was no alcohol. And every now and then, Mama would come in there and fetch the guys there, and they get beat too, you know? I was raised in the sunny and fair era. You can tell I have curly hair, right? But in those days, it was straight hair, right? I try to be a surfer. You can kind of see how that one cake with me, right? And I used to iron my hair. I used to put my hair down, take it with the iron. Man, the iron on my head going through with these three little holes on my head. I really think that's why I'm bent. My hair's receding right here. I'm so many slams. But, you know, I never would have made it. I'm the kind of person I fit in with any type of trick. You know, the book talks about seeking loyal companions. My mother moved us to the other side of Pomona because I was getting in so much trouble at school. You know, and I took three buses to get to the barrio. That's the ghetto. I was the best dressed chola in the barrio. Not only that, but all the girls wanted to be my friends. Why? Because they had money and I'd buy them. Not only that, they had a phone with some chick, I'd take care of it. I had a lot of suppressed anger. What happened is my mom moved us again. We moved to North Clare. And my baby said it's James Wilson. And like I said, I just said it was anyway, click. And I was going between classes and smoke a cigarette. And all the girls were talking about this guy. He was 6'3", blonde hair, blue eyes. He had a nice custom car in the car shows. He was 19. He wasn't in school. He had money. All the girls wanted to be with him. You know I had to have him. You know, I based all my value on what you thought was valuable. If you thought it was good, I got to have it, right? Anyway, I named this guy. And he introduces me to booze, wine, alcohol, and red. Shoot, I thought I was running before. You know, I don't know if you take a drink or take a sleeping pill with a wine. Anyway, I made this guy to go to this house party. And we go to the liquor store, and he's coming through the door from the liquor store. He has a bag in his hand, and there's a chick coming through, too, and she has a bag in her hand. I knew she was with him. There was a beer bottle by me. I picked it up and broke it on his face just in case. And then after that, I try to kill him again. And when he gets out of the hospital, his family sends him to Ontario, Canada. When I get out of juvenile hall, I say, I'm really going to kill this guy. And this is during the time when everybody was filming it. Some of you might, everybody used to gang up and get in the car and take off. Anyway, I decided to hitchhike. You know, I've never been out of Montclair. I'm only 16. I started filming it and I get as far as Columbus, Ohio. I want you to know there are no Mexicans in Columbus, Ohio. But I tell you what, I started partying, I started drinking, I started having fun. I forgot what my primary purpose was, right? And something happened in my home and I had to come back. And when I came back, I was into lots and lots and lots and lots of AA meetings. My mother used to bring me to AA meetings when I was bad, and I was bad a lot. And I remember I used to sit in that front row, listen to those speakers, and I'd enjoy their talk. I mean, they taught a lot of exciting things, and I tried some of them, and they were on my feet. And I figured they had a lot of fun when they were young. But now they're old, and they ain't got nowhere else to go, so they're here, right? So when I come back, I said, well, I'm going to get rid of that apple wine and those words. That stuff makes me too violent. I know what I need. I need to get me a job. I need to buy myself a car. So I buy myself a 64 Chevy, you know. The kind of a big steering wheel, but I put a little thing 6 inch so they can't see over the top, right? Get rid of that apple wine and those words. And I switch to a little 151 Bacardi, and I keep going. God, round it. We move again. We move back to Orange, where we're originally from. And I start claiming Ontario as my barrio. You know, I'm from the ghetto Ontario, and at that time, we used to let our hair real high. Back in the hair paint, when we used to put those checks in, get as big as you want. My mother would call me a lion, only in Spanish, a leona. And I put those two hair pieces in there, get it big. And wear those double eyelashes. With all those lines, right? And I've been drinking while I'm doing this real pink deal, right? And I've heard of speakers, saying that they drink and they drove. I drank when I was in the shower. I always drank. I drank and drove. I mean, I didn't even give it a second thought. I didn't even know it was wrong. Remember I used to drive over to Ontario? On Friday, right after work, we'd drink about that 151 Bacardi and Coke, and then we'd beat up the girl from out of town. The girl from Chino, right? And I was from out of town, but we'd beat up the other girl from out of town. And the next day, we'd go look for our hair before they pulled it out, right? And I did this every weekend. And on Sunday, but the morning call up Monday at 3 o'clock in the morning, but I figure if I am going to sleep on Sunday, it's still Sunday, right? So I'd be coming home, driving down the street about 3 o'clock in the morning, jumping up and down in my little ride, right? And I got to get up at 6 o'clock to go to work. So I dropped me a few little whites so I could hear the alarm, because otherwise I'll pass out, right? And I'd be laying down and the room would start spinning. And I gotta hurry up and go to sleep before those whites kick in. And it seems like I just barely close my eyes as the alarm goes off. And I get up and I got the shakes. And I drag myself to the bathroom, and I got that the taste in my mouth. That bad taste. My stomach's feeling kind of nasty, too. And I drag over there and brush my teeth, and I just give it a little quickie, nothing serious, because it makes me gag, right? And I'm thinking of that 151 Bacardi all weekend long, and I need to take a shower, but I don't, so I just had a little extra perfume nobody will notice, right? And I go to work. I never considered myself a daily drinker. Or a morning drinker. But I tell you what, when I get to my job, I drop me some rice, and if I got lucky, some black beauties. At lunchtime, I was the only girl to have an 80 ounce. We called them a kawama. To get through the day. And I would drink me that beer. I would chugger that beer down just to feel a little bit better so I could get on with my day. And when I'd go back to work, I'd have that conversation in my mind. Tonight it's going to be different. Tonight I'm going to go home and get me some rest. Tonight I'm not calling the girls. I don't know what would happen to me at 3:30 when I turn back up. I go in what the girls are doing. Put that low out of music, cruise home, and call the girls up and do it all over again. You see, at the beginning I started drinking Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then I went Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Wednesday. Then I went Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday. Good thing to blend it well, And I remember my cousin asked me to go over to his in-law's house. It must have been one of those dumb Tuesdays, those off days when I don't remember drinking, or just that lunch day that don't count. Anyway, he invited me to go to his in-law's house. I went over there and I had a shot of whiskey. I don't know about you, but a little 6-8 ounce glass of whiskey is nothing. That is an opener for me. That is just an appetizer. That's nothing. And that day I had a shot of whiskey and I blacked out. And the next day, my cousin's wife, who did not drink, came over and told me I had been over a cousin of mine, sitting on his lap and stroking his hair, and I craved at the idea because I hated him. You see, when I was a little girl, that guy was always trying to molest me, and I was terrified of him as a kid. And when he told me I did that, you know, I got a little concerned. Now, you read it in chapter 3, I swore off. I decided to go to college. You know, I started driving 7-10 miles a day, you know. I started dabbling in that other good book. I moved into a reborn, famous Christian apartment. I'm not drinking, I'm not violent. Just look a little weed, you know, weed on that. I do a weed movement, right? Because I am an alcoholic, okay? So, I mean, I started going and I started, to go to college and I started broadening my thought process, right? And I took a high class like political science, smoke a joint right before the final, and read the church and blah, 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 blah. Get a mess. Next semester, same seat, same instructor, same great notes. Never miss a day of class. Smoke a joint to relax. Get stuck on the same sentence over and over. I took that class 4 semesters in a row. I never got off the same sentence. I always got a mess. And on the last day, when I took that class, I had that thought in my mind. I know what the problem is. The problem is I'm stupid. My mother always said I was stupid and I believed her. You know, I didn't always believe her. That's over. You know, I always thought I'd do that again. Anyway, what happened is that my girlfriend brought these two guys over to my house. And I had a shot of tequila. And then it was 2 pints. She asked one of the guys where he lived. He said by the orange circle. My mother lived by the orange circle. I had a few resentments of that lady. There was a bat by me. I picked up the bat, beat the heck out of my girlfriend, bit her nipples, destroyed the furnace department. The guys left. The cops came and got a physical confrontation with the cops. Right out the door, knocked on the window of his door and said, "Break him in!" They took him in a jail. And it had been 3 years since I had a drink. 3 years. You know, like I said, I heard some stuff around AA. You know, and when I got, in fact, in those days, they used to put you in this little rubber room and let you sleep it off. And I remember in the morning when they came in, they woke me up. I had a big old black eye. One of my flappers was missing, you know, and my hair was all flat, and my nylons were ripped, my clothes were all tore up. You know, I was a mess, you know. When I got out of there, you know, a nice bus driver, he let me ride the bus for free. You know, I remember getting in that bus and seeing all you people be so clean and so smiley and so bright in the morning. And I said, you know what, I'm never going to do this again. What I did is I switched to a little social heroin. You know heroin don't say social very long? You see, I didn't do anything to keep from being an alcoholic. But it is a progressive illness. It gets worse, never better. And I switched to a little social heroin, and everything else, well, I wouldn't do, I started doing, you see. You see, what happened is I lived in one of my grandmother's homes, my grandmother that I adored. And what I did is started renting that house out to illegal aliens. You know, my grandmother lived far away, not very far, you know, a few miles, and she didn't know what was going on. And I kept renting that house over and over to illegal aliens. I figured if they told on me, I'll call immigration, take them away, and I'll be fine, right? Well, they all got together, and they told on me. I didn't even know how to use each other. You know, I have long since been on my bridges. And when they all got together and they told on me and I went to jail, you know, I remember that when I got out of jail, I had absolutely no place and nowhere to go. I had been long since then all my business, all my family, all my colleagues from school, all my professors, everybody I could think of, everybody who would allow it, I burned them. And you know, when I got out of jail, you know, I began to live what the book talks about, incomprehensible demoralization. I can barely pronounce those words. And it is the hardest thing there is, to talk about my story. You see, what happened for me is I put all my belongings in a shopping cart. I remember I was 28 years old, back in the good-looking days, you know, and I put all my things in a shopping cart. And I remember that I used to walk the streets at night, and, you know, I never sold my body out there because I didn't think anybody would buy it. You see, after heroin and alcohol and weed and everything quit working, I incorporated a little cocaine into the deal. You see, I just couldn't stand how I felt inside. I just felt that life had done me so wrong. You see, when I incorporated that little cocaine into the deal, I cooked all my eyebrows out, all my eyelashes out. I had sores all over my face, all over my eyes. I always used to think I had bugs on me, you see. I was always living in BTs. I pushed the cart on the street. I used to consider myself a pimp, but really what I was a leech. I would hang out with the ladies of the night, and they would let me sleep in the bathroom floor or somehow on the floor, and they would take care of me. I remember I used to push my cart in the daytime, and I remember there would be times when I would be hungry, and somebody would pull over and say that they would buy me something, and the people at the McDonald's and Jack in the Box would tell me that I had to stay outside. You see, and I remember when I needed to use the restroom. Do you ever wonder where homeless women use the restroom? I remember I used to go to the gas station and ask them if I could use the restroom, and they would tell me it was out of order. I remember what it is to go and try to sleep at the park in the daytime and hear all the families and all the children and be terrified to fall asleep. You know, and that's the part of my life that is the hardest to talk about. You see, you know, I were a size 7 little girl when I got sober. I weighed 76 pounds. I had no eyebrows, no eyelashes, and I had sores all over my face. I'm the kind of alcoholic you see on the corner and is talking to themselves. And people would just pull away from me. I should know about those signs. I think I had to move some box of those signs, you know. I mean, the most I could ask you for was a quarter. I really valued myself. I couldn't stand how I felt inside of me. It was so dead and yet so empty. And I remember it would be rainy days and rainy nights, and I'd be walking the street, and I'd smell like a wet dog. I think that I did have... You know what the word is? I'm a very skittish woman. I always wear a toothbrush, and I always wear a little bit of bleach. Because I'm so skittish, you know, and God always takes care of fools. And I'm one of those fools. And I remember I used to stay up all late at night. And it would be about 3 or 4 in the morning, and I'd be waiting for some warm toast and some oatmeal. So I'd go and stand in the line where they give the free food. And I remember seeing those ladies preparing the food, and I'd be the first one. And as soon as I walked down there, you know, I'd get me some cold toast. And I'd start hollering and screaming, you can tell I have a big mouth. And they would 86 me from the Salvation Army eating line. You see, I was a victim all the time when I lived on the streets. I didn't know why my life had been that way. I would see you go to work, I'd see you clean, I'd see you driving your car, and I wonder what happened to my life. I went in and out of jails many, many, many times. I'm the only one that I know that would cry when it was time to leave. You see, because that was a safe place for me. And when I got out, I had to do it all over again. And one time, I called my mother, and I had called my mother many, many, many times to help me. And this time I called my mother and I asked her for help. And she said, "For God's sake, Mama, I'm making dinner for Johnny's ass." She goes, "If you want to get over, you go to the station, won't you?" She had a little attitude, you know. I never heard of Indio. She said, "Someplace by Tom Springs." I told everybody in that jail, "I'm going to bed for it. I'm going to be selling the money with Elizabeth Taylor." You know, I tell you what I look like. I would have never fit in with Elizabeth Taylor, you know. But she said she was going to send me to the best recovery on the TV. So that's what I thought I was going to bed for. And what happened is somebody, you know, when you live on the street, I got sober when I was 34. I was 28. Last time I remember when I hit the street. I was in jail. And they said, "Let's go to 7-Eleven. So instead of calling a sober call to pick me up, I go with them to 7-Eleven. And when I'm walking there, I start feeling that impending doom the book talks about. So I ran back to the jail. I called the lady up. She picks me up. She takes me to Riverside. At Riverside, my mother picks me up. You know, I got all that stuff with her. You know, she's having that conversation. Some of you might have a potion of. She said, Nina, give yourself a break. This can be the last time you ever go through that. You know, I keep going on and on and on and on. And I'm shaking in that chair. I'm feeling 5 years old again. And we get up. I don't know if you guys have ever been to Indio, but it's all sand and covering. I go, shoot, man. I don't know where we're at, but I mean, I think we're going to Central Office and to Betty Ford and the Med and all that jazz. We pull up in front of their house. It's a two-story house, and nobody's there. It's in an office building. So we roll around the back, go down this alley, and on one side of the alley is a shooting gallery. I mean, that's where I live. You know, that's an old, broken-down house that has graffiti over it, and cats living in it. It smells like, you know, fraud, and the windows are... I mean, I know that place. And across the other alley was four cats. I don't know what cats mean. These mice. I wish you knew I got loaded in better places than this. I'm so arrogant. And I always remember those old people. And bigger than who's my look at this old lady down the steps. She came to sleep on the couch and don't use the phone. You know, all night I'm thinking, where can I call somebody to get me out of here? But like I said, I had long, long, long since burnt my bridges. And when that sweet old woman who has passed away, she took me into her office and she did an intake on me. She asked that question you're not supposed to ask arrogant people. She asked me what my drug of choice was. And I said, heroin. And she said, did you ever use alcohol? And I said, yes. And she said, can you see how your alcoholism led you to try other things? And I believe that that was my first moment of clarity. She said, we identify ourselves as an alcoholic. We no longer want to be different. The person that might save your life that day might just be an alcoholic and not relate to the other. And she said, when you get a sponsor and you work the steps. I got a sponsor who had 27 years of sobriety. I wanted someone who knew some stuff. Not only that, but my mother had 23 and a half years of sobriety, and my sister had 8 years of sobriety, and I didn't want to kill those cats. You know, and I forgot to tell you, during that weed time when I was smoking weed, my sister called me up, and she told me that she was going to AA. God, I got so resentful that she was going to AA. I could probably raise just want to be like my mom. So I sent her a little weed. She broke her sobriety. Obviously, she wasn't fun. I got to move that out, okay? I have gotten to make amends to my sweet sister that I adore. You see, so I got a sponsor and I started working the steps. And I tell you that when I was 8 years old, that shit got out of my life. I was never one of those people that went to jail and said, God get me out of this one. I never said God to my mouth. Never. Never, never said God peace. Despite that, I'm still sober. I went to that recovery home and I started doing my steps. You know, I just couldn't get that part that said that I was insane. You know that second step? I could see how my life was unmanageable. I could see how I was powerless. But I didn't think I was crazy. You see, I was living on the streets, talking to myself, shopping on other people's clotheslines. Really not a jazz fan. None of us are jazz fans. You know, I was not a dumpster diver. I only ate out of good trash cans at Holiday Inn, Yes, and that was good trash for me, right? But I don't think I was crazy. I did not think that was crazy behavior. I was about 4 months older when I recognized this was a God deal. But then it was too late. You know, I was walking, and it must have been about noon in the afternoon, and I was walking through that club. And somehow, it came to me, and it said, you know, Nana, you've been a phony all your life. Just pretend there's something. And in the desert, it's windy. And I closed the window, and I asked my God. And, you know, the moment that I could hear the trees move. I could see the trees move, but I could not see the wind. And every time it touched my face, I acknowledged that that was God. And the morning I would say, please keep me sober today. And the night time I said, thank you. And that's how my journey began. I had 7 affairs in my first year and a half as a baby. And what I learned from that is that God uses my defects of character to feed me what I'm supposed to do. You see, because when I got here, when I was a newcomer, you guys lived here together. You know, I got sober in Palm Springs in India, and you guys looked too white. You guys looked... I just never felt enough, and they made me feel good. You know, they were the attraction. They wanted to spend time with me. They wanted to get to know my story. And I remember the first time I ever went to a women's meeting. I thought, well, there's one other Mexican that was in the desert. And we're at this meeting, right? And she gets up in the middle of the meeting and she starts serving coffee. And I said, oh, they make the Mexican serve the coffee, yeah? And I told her, right? And she said, no, Mama, I do it because I love them. I do it because they keep me sober. They teach me. They help me. They carry me. And I do it out of gratitude. And so I started working my steps. When I was, I think I was 8 months sober. Or I was 8 months sober. On November 27th of 1989, I was allowed to have a little part-time job. And it was right before the holidays, and it was after Thanksgiving. And the assistant manager asked me to take the Christmas tree down and from the attic. So it was about the high 2 stories. And so I said, why do I have to do it? They had to put one of the guys. I'm the only kid. I should not be moving that heavy stuff. So I'm only walking up the stairs all resentful. And I'm taking the Christmas trees out all angry. I'm moving. And as I get further and further into the attic gives away. And I saw 2 stories. And I'm flying through that 2 stories. And I'm going so fast, and I slam into those metal shelves that they have at Home Depot. And I'm going so fast that it springs me back up again. And I fall down the final destination, where the floor, right? And I land on my feet both times. And you know what? I didn't break anything. Just a couple of teeth, but there was probably about that anyway, you know what I mean? And that day, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that God had a plan for me. Not to myself, I would have saved myself. But that is the truth. That day is the day when I knew, without no reservations, that God had a plan for my life. I failed to tell you that I was in a 12-year relationship when I was running those affairs. I moved back to Los Angeles to make my amends. I'm also here to tell you, don't get all in love once that just because you get sober. I tried for 5 years to get that relationship in order and I could not. When I was 16 months sober, 14 months sober, who can count? My grandmother that I adored died. And at that time I got mad at God. I said, take my mama, take my sister, don't go away, give me my grandma back. You see, I had no money to my grandmother, but I wasn't done loving on her. I wasn't done spending time with her. I wasn't done getting to know her and be with her and sharing myself with her. But you know, when God takes something away, He always replaces it with something else. And what I had to do is I had to pick up the piece of paper and pen, and I had to do 5 more inventories on my mother and my sister so I could let them off the hook. You see, because I want a Mexican family. You know, with a bunch of kids and a lot of noise and beef. We don't got that. There's only 4 of us, you know, and I'm never going to have that. And my sister, she's never been in a Mexican. You know what I think? I have all this delusion in my head. You know, it's what I think they should be like. They can't be any more than who they are. You know, that's what I learned from those women. They allow them to be who they are. I don't have to like what they do. I don't have to like what they say. I just have to love them. So who they belong to me. They are my sister and they are my mother. And I love them. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a beautiful relationship with them. When I was a kid, I was so jealous and envious of my sister, and I adore my sister. She is my best friend. So I moved back to Los Angeles, and I started being self-supporting through my own contributions. I worked at this job for 5 years. I was kind of terrified about getting a job, you know, because what have I been doing for 10 years? You know, my TLW did not look cute. You know, I did not attend to the county jail. I did not attend to the hospital. I didn't even know I went to the hospital so many times. My TLW was a mess. I was a manager at a sports facility, and I couldn't even get airhead water delivered to us because I was a manager, right? I remember one time I sent Citibank my $1,000 for a secure visa, and they sent it back to me and said, thank you, but no thank you. It took me 3 years to clear up my CRW, paying one payment at a time, talking to each place one at a time. And what happened for me is that when my grandmother died, she left me some money. And I remember one of the women on that list, I went over to her house to make my amends to her. And I remember I was getting my car, I was thanking God for allowing me to do this, for giving me the courage to do this. And when I get to her house, I knock on the door. And she says, get away from here. You don't want your kindness. You don't want your kindness. You don't get out of here. We'll call the cops. Man, we thank God he doesn't reveal everything to us all at once, you know. And I pause and I'm shaking and I don't know what I did. And you know, I remembered. You know, when I lived on the streets, you know, the cops stopped you, you get tested, you're supposed to go to court, don't go to court, you get a warrant. And when the cop comes again, you give him another name, you get another warrant. And anyway, I picked up a few family beef in the name, you know, and he was a little example. He got picked up for him. So I'm standing in front of the house. It was only me and God. And I remember this. And I pause and I ask God to help me. And I knocked on the door again and I said that I was sorry for any pain I had caused her, that I wasn't there to win her friendship, that I was only there to right the wrong I had done. And she opened the door and I went inside and told her what I was doing there. She said, yeah, sure. Her mom and all her family came and made amends to them all. And they said, good job, keep it up, blah, blah, blah. And they didn't take my check. They didn't want my money, right? Something like that extra money, right? 2 weeks later, she called me up and she told me she wants the money. I get a little resentful. I want to call my sponsor. She could have put the money when I was offering it to her, right? Now I'll get the off, right? But you know how sponsors be ruining stuff. And my sponsor says, give him back the money, Mama. You're only holding it for them. Like I said, I tried to end that 17-year relationship, and I could not. I made a conscious decision to end that relationship. And about 3 months later, that job that I worked for 5.5 years was sold, and they turned me down. New owners told me they were going to keep me. And an hour before the takeover, they gave me my severance pay. And one time I felt, why two? And one more time I felt like, now what is going to become of me? You see, because I always thought that job is who made me. I always thought that relationship was who I was. And I remember gathering all my things, and I went home, and I was crying. And I got to my bed, and I got on my knees, and I thank God for allowing me to experience the pain. You see, I'm always quick to thank God for the good things, but I don't thank God for the lessons. And I remember what Mother Teresa said. She said, God doesn't give you more than you can handle, but she wished you didn't have so much confidence in her. I knew what she meant that day. And so I decided I wanted to sell cars. That's where I want to be when I grow up. And so I started selling cars, and I was a number one sale of cars chick. For the first month, I sold 14 cars. I gave them all away. When you come to look for that corner, I said, don't you pay that sticker price? There's $4,000 in there offering this. Anyways, I couldn't make any money that way, so that one will save you money out and do you a good deal. Anyway, I'm staying home, and I'm getting unemployment, I'm living on my savings. I love staying home. I love going to meetings, I love talking on the phone, I love going to afternoon, I like, you know, puttering around my house. But then we have a thing called a sponsor. And she should just have to put in for her own contribution. I love self-supporting. It's my unemployment, my savings. She goes, what is it, Bella? She goes, I go, it's my savings. She goes, and that's what you do, you save it. She goes, I want you to put 3 resumes a week. So I know you guys aren't like me, because you're not defiant. I took a paper and jump for, and I looked through it. I took 3 places I don't want to work. You know, and I faxed my resume to them. Some guy calls me up and tells me what it is. And I'm reading it up in my book. I'm talking to one of the women I sponsor. You know, and I tell him, thank you, but no, thank you. I'm not interested, right? About Tuesday, he calls me again. He says, well, I'm going to a seminar. I'd be happy to pay for it. Would you like to go? So, you know, I go all the way. I go to my sponsor, going to anywhere. You know, I'm a woman, everything, you know, and so I go to the seminar, and I listen, and then I come back, he takes me to the office, and he tells me, so what do you think? I go, it sounds okay. And he goes, what does it pay? And he tells me what it pays. I go, oh, no, I can't work for that. I need $400 more a month. He goes, okay. And then he goes, when can you start? And I go, only got 2 weeks of teaching. He goes, okay. So about 3 days before I start to start my job, I call over to come on and start on 8:15, and I figure the joke would be on him next to me, go stay 3 months, you know, just to get the heat off from the sponsor, right? I stayed on that at that job for 3 years, 11 months, and 2 weeks. And what that taught me is that I don't know what's good for me. That God is in charge of my life. That God always uses my defects. You see, this is my interpretation. You know when you have a little tiny baby puppy, and they're so little and cute, and you hold them close, and they grow up and smell like bologna? You know they smell like bologna? And in the nighttime, you make them a little place to sleep. And in the morning, when you go see that puppy, you smell these little tiny poopies and slam their foot in it. They're always stepping it. I don't know why they step on it. But you get the little puppy and you clean up all the poop and you love them and you send them on the way. And I believe that that's how God looks at my defects of character. Because without them, I won't make any change. And what happened is that job was going through some financial problems and I had to get another job. And you know what? I always have a room and everything. But God has a plan for me. You see, I have more than I need. I never did a good deed to deserve sobriety. I have more than I deserve because God has given me mercy and not justice. You know, and I have a beautiful relationship with my higher power. See, God brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous and He taught me about God. The steps introduced me to God. I have gotten to live 2 lifestyles in 1 lifetime. And it's been for free and for fun. And you know, I'm never going to do it the way you think I should do it. And I'm probably never going to be able to do it the way I could do it. But I thank God I'm not doing it like I used to do it. Thank you.